Damn it, John, I was about to read that.
Nope, save it for later.
Wow. Is that how tonight's going to go?
I have that covered later in the follow-up section. It's all in there.
See, this is what I get for messing with the King's follow-up. My apologies. All right.
What do you think follow-up comes with? The follow-up fairy comes at night? That's in the notes. You're just like, you wake up, it's like Christmas morning. Wow, this follow-up under the tree. You don't question where it comes from.
No, I know it comes from the King. So, King, would you like to start our follow-up about the Apple of cars?
Only if you give me a nickname that's distinct from Marco, who you also call the King.
That's true.
Wait, I'm the King of something?
Start calling Declan the King. We'll see how that goes.
What am I the King of?
Yeah, I don't know. Mufflers? I don't know. Fracture app icons? Something like that. So the first item is a tweet from Daniel Silva talking about whether Tesla is the Apple of cars, and he gave a link to a Consumer Reports owner survey asking about repair experiences, and I was saying that independent repair shops outscored dealership services with one exception, and that exception was Tesla, which had excellent customer sat, which totally makes it the Apple of car.
We need a sound effect for that, maybe just like a thud.
Seriously.
What is the sound of one customer sitting? Customer sat.
God. Yeah, see? Thud.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so bad, John. All right. So, yeah. So, Tesla has great customer sat. Thus, they are the Apple of cars.
Well, I mean, to be fair, as people pointed out on Twitter, like, since this is a thing about repair experiences, Teslas have only been around for a short time. So, they're all pretty darn new. So, maybe the repair experience is great just because they're all under warranty and are relatively new. So, maybe it's not particularly fair. But anyway, I just thought I would throw that in there as a little appetizer for automotive follow-up.
All right, well, what's our salad course then?
Yeah, so now we have Apple's making a minivan. You know, the whole minivan rumor. And I don't remember where I read this, but as with a lot of things in the Apple car rumor stories, it's just sort of said, it's like, did someone see a minivan? Or did you just hear from these unnamed sources that they're making a minivan? Or like, we don't even know from whence does this minivan business come? It's just, anyway. And we were talking about why that might be. Maybe it's just kind of a snub-nose thing or stuff like that. And I think Keith Huss was the first person to point out that the possibility that, I think this is in his fault, but anyway, other people said this as well, that it might just be a test mule, like, you know, where they're testing drivetrain or internal stuff or whatever, and that the outside shape of the car has nothing to do with what's inside it. Kind of like Columbus, the set-top box that Apple is almost certainly going to introduce in 1998. Is a flat black rectangular box. Of course, Columbus turned out to be the iMac. Turns out, as with computers and cars, of course, the outside shape of the thing can have absolutely no bearing on the product that you actually make. And I think that one of the other examples that someone gave was like, look at those iPhone prototypes. They were crazy and they were big. I think Columbus is an even better example because that was such a great fake out of the internals of this computer have to fit in a certain size, but nobody but the industrial design people knew that the thing that was wrapped around that was going to be a translucent teal gumdrop type thing. And so car companies do have sort of test mules that are either heavily disguised or actually bear little resemblance to the final car. I think maybe, Casey, or if you've read a lot of car magazines, or Marco, like, do you remember a case where someone, like a car manufacturer, was testing the drivetrain for a new car by wedging it into something that looked like their old car? I have vague memories of that.
Well, even just last week, there, you know, BMW announced they're going to do a 7-seater SUV, the X7.
Oh, God, I was just about to bring that up, you jerk.
Yeah, like a few days ago, there were these spy shots of what they basically took an X5, I think, or an X3. They took one of their existing smaller SUVs and just bolted a bunch of weights to the roof and the hood and are testing it that way by like simulating the bigger car that would be on the same chassis and drivetrain and everything.
That's slightly right. So I have a link, which we'll put in the show notes. BMW X7 testing using modified 7 Series prototype.
Oh, that's right. It was a sedan, right?
Exactly. So yes, this looks like a next generation G11 7 Series prototype, but look closer and you will see BMW has ingeniously added weights to the roof and inside the car and raised the hood to accommodate a different engine/intake setup in order to air quotes test the basic X7 drivetrain package. And so, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to bring up, Marco, and that sounds very similar to what you're describing, John.
And Keith Huss's additional thing is like, look, if you're going to be testing internal stuff like screens or whatever, and you will have to have a bunch of equipment hooked up to it to monitor it. A minivan type shape leaves lots of room for sort of engineers to be sitting with their little equipment or laptops or connected to the thing with cables or whatever and monitor everything while you're in the car. Like, so it's sort of a if it's just internal stuff, it would be like a mobile lab for stuff that happens inside the car. And if it's a whole car type thing, then it could be a drivetrain mule or any other type of thing. And that anyone seeing anything looking like a minivan may have nothing to do with anything that the final product is going to look like.
Well, and also, I mean, there's a lot of popular car shapes these days, especially in the US, that look kind of like minivans. Like, if you say, like, it's kind of like a minivan, that could encapsulate lots of crossovers, large hatchbacks, things like the Prius V that I don't think they called a minivan, and it's pretty small for a minivan, but it's kind of minivan shaped. Like, there's a lot of cars that are near that shape or near that profile. Actually, probably even more in Europe because they like hatchbacks so much more than we do.
Well, there's another great example with the BMW i3, which a few people wrote in, justifiably a little annoyed that we didn't bring that up.
We did, though. I thought we mentioned the i3. When we were in the discussion of the i8, one of you briefly brought up the i3, but no, we didn't talk about it in the minivan type thing, although I did mention the Spark car and like other cars that don't have a lot of front overhang because there's no engine.
Right, right. And so anyway, the point being the BMW i3, in case you're not aware, is there, I believe it's either a hybrid or pure electric. Is that correct?
I think it's hybrid.
Suffice to say that it looks like a very, very shrunken minivan, almost like a bigger smart car. So to kind of build upon what you were saying, John, that you could construe the i3 as a minivan if you didn't really know what you were talking about, even though it's, you know, half the size of your average American minivan. Do you want to talk about poaching?
You can poach a car?
These are in the category of stories that broke since we recorded last week's episode, which we recorded on a Wednesday, as we always do, recording this one on a Wednesday. Shortly after we recorded it, there were more stories that put, you know, even more smoke to this rumor. And the New York Times one was, getting engineers to build a battery division, right? And, an automaker type engineers. Well, those people might have expertise in also helping them build phone and iPad batteries, sure, but probably their expertise is much more involved in very large batteries for things like cars. And if you're doing CarPlay, you probably don't have any reason to get people who have expertise in building car-sized batteries. So there's a little bit more smoke there for, like, are they doing something other than just extending CarPlay or doing maps or something like that? And I think the big one is, again, last week we were talking about, oh, they hired a bunch of these people, but I was saying, wouldn't they be hiring more people who are like mechanical engineers or drivetrain engineers or people know about building cars? Because all we saw was like, all right, fine, some executives, like someone's got to lead these car people. So get some executives. They don't know how to do anything anyway. They just tell people what to do. Right? Executives from Ford, head of R&D at BMW. That's all we saw with those, like a handful of big names. And then everything else was just an amorphous number. It's like, oh, and they're hiring a bunch of employees and poaching from Apple teams. Like, well, where are the people who know how to build cars? And so 9 to 5 Mac did this huge breakdown of, here's a bunch more names. Instead of just the names of the bigwigs that we're saying are in charge of this, here's a bunch more names. And if you go through these names and look at what their experience and expertise are in, they're in things that have much more to do with building cars or working on cars, like the car part of the cars. It's still a short list. It's not hundreds of people. It's not an exhaustive headcount, but it sure looks a lot more like people who would be working on an actual car and not people who would be working on CarPlay.
Yeah, I agree. I felt the same way that, man, this could be construed as a car, but I'm not so convinced. And especially after this 9 to 5 Mac piece, if nothing else, they got to be toying with the idea of building an actual car. Otherwise, all these hires just seem kind of silly to me. But yeah, it's weird. I last week I would have told you there's a 10% chance this is actually happening, insofar as that they're actually even trying to build something, even if they scrap it. Jason Snell actually had a really good piece on Six Colors where, in short, he said, well, you know, a lot of companies will try things and throw some spaghetti against the wall, if you will, and see what sticks. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't stick, and that's okay. And that certainly it certainly seems as though Apple is at the very least seeing if they have anything to contribute here. And this 9 to 5 Mac piece further corroborates that in my mind.
Yeah, assuming it's true, because it's not like Apple is confirming these people. But like, just to pick one random name out of this list here, this is David Nelson. He's from Tesla, and according to his LinkedIn at Tesla, he was served as the mechanical engineering manager leading a team responsible for modeling, predicting, modeling prediction and verification of motor and gearbox performance and efficiency. You do not need a mechanical engineer who knows about motor and gearbox performance and efficiency if you're working on CarPlay or a Street View thing. Like, people like this, I don't know how you would explain that these people exist at all. It even kind of kills, again, if this is true, the idea that, oh, Apple's just going to like partner with somebody and take over their entire interior and do it. Like, why the hell would you need someone for, you know, for reliability and warranty projects and modeling gearbox? And like, this is people for building a car. Like that, and that's just one list, one person from this page. So you just go through them all, and I don't know how you can finish this and say, look, if Apple hired all these people, what the hell are they doing with them other than building a car?
That's the thing. I mean, and this is, you know, we got so much feedback, really good feedback this week. People giving us all sorts of ideas, some of which I'm sure we're going to talk about in the next few minutes. All sorts of ideas. A lot of people are saying, like, you know, what if Apple is not quite building a car, but what if they're addressing the problem of transportation in a bigger way? Maybe it's a non-traditional approach, something like, you know, car sharing or transportation networks of different sorts, and like these bigger picture ideas that all kind of begin like, well, they're going to solve something in a totally different way. And another common explanation is, well, maybe they're going to, you know, build the car OS and license it to car makers and or partner with somebody to make the car for them. And I think just looking at this, it is much more likely that they're actually trying to build a car than anything else. Like any other alternative explanation of like what they might be doing with all these people instead, it is just looking more and more likely. If the more attention you pay to this, the more information that comes out in bits and pieces and rumors, the more it looks like there's a lot of smoke behind this, and that it is way more likely than any other explanation that they are just actually trying to build a car. And then to address like the what if they do something different, or what if they do something non-traditional, or solve a bigger problem, I think that's a lot like, you know, we have to look at every previous Apple launch. And like before the watch came out, we were talking, well, you know, what if they do something different? And it's not really a watch. It's some kind of wearable that's not a watch, but it does other things. And then it came out and it's like, nope, it's a watch. It's just done well. You know, same thing like when the iPad came out, and me and other bloggers at the time were talking like, you know, what if they do a tablet? How do they solve the input problem? And how big is it? How do they solve the problem of it being between sizes? And the answer was they didn't solve those problems. They just made a good tablet. Typically, when Apple solves problems like this, they don't do something that no one's ever heard of. They just do a really good job with things that people generally have heard of or that are cutting edge. And so if they make, you know, looking at this project, these rumors and these people and everything else, it sure looks like, as I said, it sure looks like they are making a car. That's what all these people are probably for. And if they are making a car, rather than having some kind of grand reinvention of everything, it is far more likely that they're just going to try to make a really good car. In the traditional sense of how we know cars. Like, I don't, and, you know, maybe it'll be pure electric, you know, that's fine. That's still within the realm of a car, you know, and it's very different, and we'll get to that later, but it is just so much more likely that the story is more boring than we all think, and more boring than a lot of people are trying to predict. Like, people are thinking that, oh, it has to be something crazy. It has to be some like cockamamie scheme to do some crazy thing. And the answer is probably no. It's probably just a car that they're hoping is going to be really good.
Yeah, I certainly agree that there's a lot more smoke around this potential fire than there was even just a week ago. Do you want to tell us about something that's cool?
Absolutely. Our first sponsor this week is CocoConf. CocoConf, these are long-term friends of ours, sponsored both our show and my site back forever ago when I did sponsors. Really great people behind CocoConf. Now, CocoConf is a touring training conference for iPhone, iPad, and Mac developers. They bring some of the best authors, trainers, and speakers to the most passionate, engaged developers in a region. Together, they make magic. Now, they travel all around the country, maybe even the world, but at least all around the U.S. And so do you live in Chicago, D.C., Portland, or Austin? If so, listen carefully. They're going to Chicago on March 27th, Washington, D.C. on April 10th, Portland on May 8th, and Austin on May 29th. And speakers on this tour this year include Nevin Mergon, Gene McDonald, Laura Savino, Daniel Steinberg, Dave Wiskus, and our very own Casey Liss.
Hi.
Hey, who are you?
Who the hell is that guy anyway?
Which one are you speaking of? The DC one?
Yes, sir. As far as I know, I'm doing the opening keynote again this year. That may or may not be true, but I believe it to be true. So if you ever wanted to come and say hi and learn a little bit about doing iOS and Mac development, you should definitely check it out. I went last year and did the opening keynote then as well. And it's a lot of fun. It's a really good show. The Klein family does a really good job. And you can learn a lot in not a lot of time and for not a lot of money. So you should definitely check it out. And like I said, if for no other reason, you can come say hi to me while you're there, which is exciting.
That's that. I would go just for that. I almost did actually last year. But I couldn't make it work. But yeah, I've heard only great things about CocoaConf. Anyway, so yeah, Chicago, DC, Portland, Austin. Check these out. Register by March 20th and use the coupon code ATP for a 20% discount on any spring CocoaConf ticket. This discount is also available for this cool special event they're doing in April called Yosemite, which will be held in the heart of Yosemite National Park, and includes speakers Andy Anatko, Michael Lopp, Jim Dalrymple, Brent Simmons, Krista Mergan, and Serenity Caldwell. Really check that out. I mean, that's actually my son's birthday, so I can't go, but man, I would love to go to that otherwise. That looks like an amazing event. So check this out, CocoConf.com. And don't forget to use the coupon code ATP for 20% off any spring ticket by March 20th. Definitely, once again, check it out. Thanks a lot to CocoConf for sponsoring our show once again.
All right. So we're like two items down in the 300-item follow-up.
No, we got to be past a whole bunch of them. In fact, we can skip this one that Bloomberg says that Apple wants to start producing cars by 2020, because that one is just more of the classic, like, you think you have rumors? Well, we're going to tell you when they're going to ship it. In fact, and if it doesn't ship by 2020, it's late. the slug in the URL is Apple said to be targeting car production as soon as 2020. Which just leaves them open to say, well, we didn't say 2020. It could be as soon as 2020. If it's sooner, they'll be like, well, that kind of fits. If it's later, like, we just said as soon as 2020. Like, what does that even mean? Anyway, I don't like that one. what did you just remove? You just removed the next one I was going to read.
Yeah, but it's unrelated.
Follow-up battle.
No, it's real. They're all related to car stuff. It was the sugar water one you just moved.
Yes,
right?
But I thought we could cover it at the end. But since you brought it up, John, I guess we'll talk about it now.
Yeah. Well, you know, Marco jumped the queue by taking the thing I deleted from the show notes and talking about it before my sponsor. So it's just chaos. It's follow up chaos today.
This is why I don't edit the show notes.
Yeah. Well, you should at least look at them. Anyway, the sugar water thing that Casey just deleted. These two.
I moved it. I didn't delete it. Yeah, moved it.
The title of last week's show was something like, do you want to sell sugar phones for the rest of your life or something? That's a reference to a line that we said in the show. And Marco and Casey asked, hey, do we want to put a link in the show notes that explains that for the people who don't know? And they were adamant that we not do that. I thought we should put a show notes link, but that's what the show notes are for. If you hear something on their show and you're like, what the hell are they talking about? You go to the show notes and click the link and it will explain it. But
every joke and reference has to be explained.
No, it doesn't have to be explained. There just needs to be an explanation. And if you don't get it and are seeking an explanation, like, you defined one so you can follow along with everybody else and get it the next time we reference it.
Can we write it at the bottom of the page upside down?
Yeah. It'll be a swipe thing, swipe to read, you know, to highlight. It's white on white text. So we didn't get any feedback about that, so I guess everybody understood it, because, you know, you're listening to a tech nerd podcast for you know, people who like Apple and stuff. You know about this, and if you didn't, I guess you could Google it, or you don't care what the title was. But anyway, if you're wondering what the hell we're talking
this
about,
this is the worst show.
Yeah, well, we're explaining things. How do people become, like, we have a shared history and knowledge and culture of this Apple stuff. How do people gain that knowledge so they too can share in these jokes? Someone has to tell them, or they have to experience it. Like, you have to invite people into your culture by explaining your shared heritage, so then they can. Anyway, this is how it works. You don't just be like, we can't tell them because they're not one of us.
Step one: watch every episode of The Simpsons from the last 25 years.
Yeah, if you just watch Triumph of the Nerds, Robert Cringely's PBS series, which is where this quote is from. I don't know if it was published before that. Anyway, Steve Jobs, when he was at Apple the first time, was trying to recruit a new CEO for the company, and he went to John Sculley, who was working at Pepsi, and was trying to get him to come to Apple and leave his cushy job at Pepsi. And his pitch to him as they were strolling through a garden or whatever was,
you want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come with me and change the world?
And that's what got John Sculley to come, and then John Sculley eventually ousted Steve Jobs in a boardroom battle. So that was not a great move on Steve's part, using his persuasion to bring the guy who would kick him out of the company. But anyway, that's what happened. Everybody knows that sugar water quote because it's such a, you know, whatever you're doing at your company, like Pepsi, selling people sugar water and giving people diabetes, you're not doing anything good. You're wasting your talents. Come to Apple and we'll change the world. And the comparison to Tesla was like, if you just want to make like, well, you're making smartphones and they already did change the world. But if you really want to change the world now, you should be making electric cars. So come to Tesla and we can do that. And that's how Tesla could lure people away from Apple. How Apple could get them to stay is you don't have to go to Tesla to make an electric car. We're doing that here. So the link we'll put in the show notes is actually a video from this documentary, which is great. You should watch it, Triumph of the Nerds, from the 90s or something. This is before Steve Jobs came back to Apple.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it before, you definitely should watch it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I know a lot of people are critical of it. I actually really liked it.
Yeah, it's overly dramatic and silly and like, you know, it's not. Yeah.
That's where the no taste quote was from, too. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, but it has footage like for whatever you may feel about like the story that apply that it slaps on top of the history of PCs to make it interesting and dramatic. There are interviews with important people in the industry where they get asked interesting questions and give interesting answers. So you can just ignore the surrounding silliness and just watch the interviews. And even just for that, it's great.
All right. Do you want to talk to us about what Helmut wrote in?
Yeah, we didn't. I'm surprised we didn't get more feedback about this because we were discussing in the last episode lots of different possibilities of Apple working with car makers or not working with them and how car companies wouldn't want Apple to come in and become the most important differentiator in their car because then what are they doing? They don't want to have happen to them what happened to the music industry or the cell phone carriers where Apple is the valuable part and they're just sort of like the stuffing or whatever. And I guess we didn't get feedback on this because people either didn't know about this or understood that we understood this, but every car company has part suppliers that put, you know, that make things that go into the cars. Like you name any car company, they probably don't make the transmission or the radio, the speedometer, the seats, like they're different.
The fancy sensors, like the rain sensors and the automatic headlights, like all that stuff is usually from outside.
Airbags.
Right. Everything comes from some other vendor. But like, that's how the auto industry works. Like I make parts for whatever, like I'm a separate company. I'm not part of GM, but the whole purpose of my company is to make parts for GM or these other car makers. And there are a few well-known brands that you would say, okay, well, these cars from Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Chrysler, like, what do they all have in common? They all have ZF gearboxes, right? Who the hell is ZF? Like, and the reason this didn't come up is, like, if you're a gearhead, you know about ZF, and you know about Bosch, and you know about, like, all these other companies that make things. But none of those companies end up being the differentiator. You're like, I want the car with the ZF transmission. From year to year, the same exact car can have a different transmission. It's like, oh, well, this model year, this car has this transmission, and next model year has a transmission from an entirely different vendor. That's not advertised. It's not an important model changeover. It's just like, oh, they changed the transmission. Like, it is not a headline feature. Regular people do not know who makes the transmission in their car, right? They only know that, oh, maybe they changed to an 8-speed automatic instead of a 5-speed or whatever. That's how the car industry works. And that is an acceptable relationship for everybody involved for probably historic reasons. And a great example is for like infotainment systems, like the, you know, the BMW iDrive and the Mercedes command system. And, you know, all the things that have like a screen and some little wheel that you move or a touchscreen or whatever. There are only a few companies that make those things. And in fact, a single company makes those systems for BMW, Audi, Mercedes, Chrysler, and one other company that I'm forgetting. It's Harman in Connecticut. It's the same company that does Harman Kardon, I think. They make the infotainment systems for all of those cars. And so you say, well, I like BMW system. I don't like the Mercedes system. They're both made by the same manufacturer to the specifications of the car company to some degree. But those companies aren't making the screens and the little dials and the software and everything and the operating system that goes on. This is one company doing this. That's how the auto industry works. But the very important part is, that's not, you don't know that. You don't know who supplies these parts. And from year to year, the car makers can change suppliers who do these, and they can decide to bring this in-house and outsource this to a different company and pit suppliers against each other in the same way that only super nerds know that like Marco's computer has like the bad LG screen or whatever that has the image retention issues. And the good one was like the Samsung one. Like nobody else knows that. Apple is not afraid that people are going to decide that Samsung is the important differentiator in their products. Like nobody knows that Samsung makes the system on a chips for iOS devices for years. But in any kind of a relationship where Apple is going to do stuff, Apple is not going to be content to be merely a part supplier to the auto industry. I mean, even CarPlay is distinctly an Apple thing. When they were on the road promoting CarPlay, you sure as hell knew that Apple was bringing you CarPlay and that it worked with your iPhone, and that was what always was 100% an Apple thing. Even if they're not giant Apple logos all over the screen, there is no hiding the fact that it was Apple. Whereas nobody knows who makes the, you know, do I have Goodyear tires, Michelin tires? Like, you don't even know what the hell the tires on your car are unless you're a gearhead. So if you don't know about the auto industry and you read about this and get confused, and yeah, why can't Apple be one of those things? Because that's just not how Apple operates, but that is how the auto industry operates. So there's a disconnect with Apple being involved in the auto industry in any way, because the relationship that the auto industry is used to is one that Apple is not interested in.
Do you have any idea how much of that approach is also true of Tesla? For example, are the motors designed and built in-house? Are the batteries designed? And I think the batteries are designed, if not built in-house. Well, aren't they building a huge factory for batteries or something like that?
Yeah, what they're going to do with the batteries is, like, we start with raw materials and out the other end comes out a battery, which is reminiscent of like the Macintosh. One of the original code names was like sand for their thing. It's like sand goes in one end and completed Macintoshes go out the other, because, you know, sand, silicon, stuff like that. Anyway, that's actually an interesting comparison. Like, so for Tesla, their whole freaking car practically was from Lotus in the beginning, because they just took a Lotus. They bought like a rolling chassis from Lotus and then just jammed their battery pack into it. Right. These days, I'm assuming they're doing the same amount, if not slightly more, in-house stuff than everyone else. But yeah, they have other suppliers. You know, I don't think they're making their brake rotors or their brake assemblies. Like, I think they're operating like any other car manufacturer, where they, various part suppliers make things, and you know, if you, they can make things to your specifications and to your design, or if they have something previously available, like, we already have this brake rotor in this size, if you just want to buy it from us, like, you don't have to design your own special brake rotor, or maybe they think they need to for their particular car. But I'm assuming that they are using part suppliers in the traditional way, because that's how they started. I mean, you know getting a whole rolling chassis from Lotus and then shoving their car inside that. I don't know if this is a further follow-up, but it's good to bring it up now. Apple, of course, does the same thing. If you look at an iPhone, you can say all the different manufacturers, like Broadcom makes the Wi-Fi chip, and Samsung was manufacturing a system on a chip until recently, and this company makes the I/O controller, and this company makes a screen controller, and who makes the screen this year, and where is the cameras coming from Sony this year? And they change the supplier all the time, and nobody knows who those controllers are, and where did they get their memory from? Did they get it from Hynix or whatever that company is, or did they get the memory from Samsung? And, like, nobody knows that. It is not a differentiator. The Apple is giving up no value by not making all these things itself. Apple doesn't own the factories that make them. Is it being made by Foxconn? Is it being made by, what is that other one? Quanta, or what is the one that starts with a Q? Anyway, like, that's how Apple operates as well, even more so, because it's like, we don't want to get our hands dirty by actually owning any factories. We will spend millions, possibly billions of dollars letting people install equipment in the factories that they will slowly pay off through some complicated relationship or manufacturing stuff for us, but they let someone else handle that. So part of this rumor is that Apple is talking to this, what is this company called? Magnasteer and Thiessen. I can't pronounce this name. It's a name I've seen in car magazines for years, but I've never had to say it out loud for a variety of reasons. A company that makes parts for fancy cars. And why would Apple be talking to them? Because they're not going to make their... I mean, I suppose they could, but, like, their inclination would be to operate somewhat like the rest of the industry. It's like, if there are part suppliers and manufacturers and assemblers for the automotive industry who already do this, Apple can contract them to say, can you make some stuff for us too? And they can. And the other option is, you know, getting back to Marco's retelling of the grand theories that readers have, is like, I bet they're going to do it all in the United States, and they're going to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and they're going to make their own factory with all U.S. people, because they're always talking about employing people in the U.S. And I suppose they could do that, and that does fit with some of the things that Apple's been doing. But on the other hand, every other thing that Apple makes tends to be made by what Apple thinks is the people who can make this best. And if the people who can make this best are a company in the United States, then fine. But if they're in China, or if they're in Germany, or if they're in any place else, I think Apple will be talking to all the best people who already know how to make car-sized things.
Our second sponsor this week is Harvest. Harvest is a beautiful business tool for tracking time spent on client projects. With Harvest, no matter where you find yourself working, the focus stays on the task at hand. You can start timers from anywhere via your web browser, desktop, or mobile device to indicate what you're working on. Tracked hours appear in beautiful visual time reports. When all is said and done, you can create invoices with billable hours right there, right in Harvest. Harvest gives you tools, data, and visualizations designed to keep projects on time and within budget. You will know which clients and projects are making you money and which ones are actually really just costing you money. Now, Casey, you do consulting work.
Mm-hmm.
How is time tracking as a general thing? It sounds like the kind of thing that would be fairly obnoxious.
Yeah, it is. Basically, I'm only useful to my company if I'm billing a client. And if you're doing work for more than one client at a time, which I'm lucky enough not to have to do, then time tracking is a freaking nightmare. And having a tool like Harvest definitely makes it considerably easier because you don't have to think about it and you don't have to remember it. And I don't know about you, but I can barely remember what I ate for dinner tonight. So I can only imagine trying to remember, well, did I work with client A from 9:14 this morning or was it 9:17? Shoot. And it's just, why clog your brain with that useless trivia? Just outsource that piece of your brain to Harvest.
Yeah, Harvest is great. A lot of people I know use them. Look, Twilling in the chat even just said they use it. I don't know if it's he or she, so I'll use they, even though I know it's incorrect. Harvest is great. If you need to track your time, it can even tell you, like, if you're benched in the parking lot or whatever that was, Casey, you can track all that if you want to with Harvest. It's great. Go to getharvest.com. That is getharvest.com. Start tracking time painlessly. You get a free 30-day trial with that. Everyone does. Just go to getharvest.com, get a free 30-day trial, try it out. At the end of the trial, enter coupon code ATP at checkout, and you will get 50% off your first month. This offer is only good till April 1st, so hurry up. Check it out today, getharvest.com, coupon code ATP after your trial to save 50% off your first month. Thanks a lot to Harvest for sponsoring our show once again.
So, John, if Apple wasn't making a car, could they be working on something car related, like maybe road signs or something like that?
You're skipping your own real time follow up about Magna making whole cars. Yes, the Magna, or they count as like an assembler or whatever. They don't just make transmissions or little parts that they ship to someone else to get assembled. Magna will put your stuff together. And I'm not sure if they entirely manufacture high end cars or do most of the assembly or anyway.
Oh, well, they did. They created the 4MATIC Mercedes all wheel drive.
Doesn't that suck?
I didn't think it sucked. I'm not saying it's particularly remarkable, but I didn't think it sucked.
Yeah, like the point about the auto industry is that the car that you think is made by a single company that sold to you under a particular brand is mostly made, like as in assembled, the parts made or whatever, by companies other than the company whose name is on the thing, right? Then they're ultimately responsible for the car. They design it. They decide what goes into it, so on and so forth. But who makes that transmission? Who makes those wheels? Who puts them all together in the right shape so that a car runs? Like, a surprising amount of that process does not involve GM, BMW, Mercedes, Audi, any of these companies, because it's all outsourced to a bunch of other smaller companies. It's mostly a symbiotic relationship because those companies, like, no one else wants an 8-speed automatic gearbox except for people who make cars. So they necessarily need to sell their parts to car makers. And I have the capability to assemble completed cars from a bunch of parts. They need car makers to use their capacity to do that. So this is the relationship. We can build cars and we can build parts that go into cars. We need car makers to buy our parts or to tell us to assemble their cars. And of course, there's the Toyota and, Honda and all the Japanese things where they run their own factories and they have a special way of doing it that assures quality and so on and so forth. But even they outsource things. And I think, who's it that licensed Tesla's drivetrain and battery technology? I think Toyota did. Like,
well, they tried to. I think it fell apart. But
yeah, well, there's a surprisingly incestuous relationship between all these car companies. I mean, to the point where, like, the Ford Probe and what the hell was it? The Ford Probe and the Mazda
323?
No, the 626 maybe. At various points, there have been cars. I mean, we even have it now, the Toyota Baru, right? it's the same car sold by Toyota and Subaru, because Subaru does the engine and Toyota does the rest of the car.
I believe that's right.
There was a relationship between Mazda and Ford where they were essentially selling the same car with different skins on it. I think I also couldn't remember the name of this car. MX-6, yes. I couldn't remember this back in neutral either. I still can't remember it. The Probe and the MX-6 were the same car, with different stuff on it. I mean, this has happened so many times over the years. So the auto industry is super weird. Like, if this happened in the tech industry, it would be like, well, you know, the Samsung S3 and the iPhone are the same phone, right? They just have a different skin on them. It's like, what? That would never happen. Happens all the time in the auto industry.
Yeah, my favorite was the Mitsubishi 3000 GT and the Dodge Stealth.
Oh, yeah. No, that was. I mean, it's totally crossed, like, cross-country lines, cross, you know, foreign, domestic, like, just Asia, Europe. There is no rhyme or reason other than just these executives, you know, mm-hmm. deciding that there are certain deals that make sense in terms of, you know, engineering resources and manufacturing capacity. And, you know, I need this and you need that. And we can cross license and sell them to each other. By the way, I always like the Mitsubishi better than the Stealth. Styling wise, but they look so similar. Like, the only thing they changed was, like, the headlight and taillight treatment and, like, the weird fake Ferrari side strakes on the thing.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see there was a made for TV movie, Knight Rider 2000, which was like 5-10 years after Knight Rider ended. Hasselhoff came back and did, like, this made for TV movie, and the Kit 2000, I think, was a custom movie, or, you know, TV car, but it was based off a Dodge Stealth, if I'm not mistaken.
I think I did see that, but I can't picture the car.
Oh, I loved it as a kid. I'm sure if I watched it again today, I'd think it is just a waste of film. But man, I was obsessed with that little TV movie as a kid.
I thought they just took the Firebird and just tacked a bunch of greebles, as they say in the business, to the thing, so it looked different. But that, I might have been thinking of something else. Greeblies. Is it Greeblies? Yeah.
I don't know. A while back, I had actually read, like, a behind the scenes on the car. But I don't have a link handy for that story, but we'll put a link in the show notes to Wikipedia for Knight Rider 2000. It's wonderfully bad made for TV movie.
Wikipedia says Greeble. I think I got it right the first time.
I'm so glad there was no other tech news this week, because this is a disaster.
All right. So yeah, now that sidetrack aside, you're talking about, this is getting into the meat of all the many, many very grand ideas that listeners have about what Apple could be doing. And like Marco said before, the general theme was, it's not about cars, man. It's about transportation.
Right. They're going to reinvent something somehow. Don't really know how yet.
Yeah. Well, no, they had specific things. All right. So one entire angle is that Tim Cook loves the environment. Apple loves the environment. They're building solar farms everywhere. Therefore, the reason they would be interested in doing a car is because electric cars are better for the environment. And so, because Apple is so environmentally focused, it makes perfect sense they would want to do an electric car, because it fits perfectly with those attitudes of the company. I agree that fits with the attitude of the company. That's not the reason you do a car, because if you are going to try to be better for the environment, of all the things that produce greenhouse gases, cars are significant, but you could get more bang for your buck by getting rid of cows or, like, buses or the many other things, or crude. Something I saw, some crazy internet stat that may or may not be true, that, like, the 12 biggest shipping, like, boats that go across the ocean with shipping containers on them, like the 12 or 20 biggest ones of the world, ones of those in the world, produce the same amount of CO2 as all the cars in the world.
Really?
It was on the internet. Who knows if it's even true? I saw it.
That sounds ridiculous.
Yes, it does. It sounds like one of those things that you read on the internet that is totally not true. So next week, I'm asking people to tell us whether that's true or not.
Once.
Yeah, just one person do it. Everyone get together and agree amongst yourselves which one of you is going to email. No, I don't care. Send a million different confirmations. Only 5 people are going to look it up anyway. So I agree that fits with Apple's motto. I don't agree that it is a strong motivating factor in deciding whether or not to build a car. You know, it could be a contributing factor, but it's like in the long list of reasons they would make a car. Because you could say that about a lot of things. Like, this is good for them. Why don't they make something that, you know, that produces electricity, like electric power plants? That would do even more for the environment. Well, because Apple is not into making power plants. Well, you know, but then why should I make a car? Another thing is, if you're going to make an electric car, one of the big impediments to electric cars has been infrastructure. Like, if I take it on a long trip, where do I recharge it? How do I recharge it? Tesla obviously has been tackling it with its supercharger stations that it's trying to put all over the United States. This is the infrastructure problem. If I can make an alternative fuel vehicle, how do I make it a viable thing to drive across the country with? You need some place to refuel it. And infrastructure like that is, you know, how many gas stations are there in the United States? This sounds like a tech job interview from 2003. how many Tesla supercharger stations are there? Far less. And so, hey, Apple's got a lot of money. They could tackle this. They could, you know, they could make sure that there are places where you can charge the electric Apple car all across the entire country. I think they could do that. Tesla has shown how difficult that is. Apple has a lot more money than Tesla. They could do a better job. In fact, I think they may have to do something like that. But like Tesla, they will be forced just by reality to start doing it in, you know, just in the San Francisco area, just in the New York area, just in the Eastern Seaboard, just up and down. Like, it's just a humongous problem. Someone says it's 388 supercharger stations, right? So how many gas stations are there in the United States? Slightly more than 388. Like, it is a very big problem. It's not like it. Look how many Apple stores have opened. It just, obviously, a supercharger station is easier to open than an Apple store, but boy, that's a long road, and it will have to be addressed sort of collectively. If Apple makes a bunch of charger stations for its car, and Tesla makes a bunch of charger stations for its car and stuff like that, that's terrible, because it would be like, well, if you get a Honda, you can only go to Honda gas stations. We need a common standard for this, and, you know, we're in early days of this, but hopefully this will shake itself out. I don't think Apple's not going to try to address this need, because if they sell electric cars, you're going to have to need somewhere to charge it, but don't expect, like, boy, now that Apple's doing it, no matter where you live in the United States, I'll be 10 minutes away from a place where I can charge up my Apple car. Unless you plan on going into people's houses and breaking in and plugging it inside their house and waiting 12 hours to charge off their house current illegally, that is not going to be the case. What else did we have from the grandiose ideas? Oh, the thing about, it's about transportation, not about cars. What about a kind of ride-sharing thing where you don't own the car, the community owns the car, and well, let's just throw into this the autonomous cars. The cars, of course, are going to drive themselves. All our listeners agree. Not Apple's cars specifically, but just all cars will drive themselves. We don't need a driver. And once they're autonomous, you don't need to own a car. You just need to have like an app that can make the car arrive, and we'll all just share cars together. And whenever you need a car, we'll come and pick you up. Like, what people are doing is slow motion fantasy, reinventing public transportation from first principles, only using cars and roads, which is perhaps the least efficient way to get lots of people from place to place. I think we talked about this last show. Self-driving cars, yeah, they're probably going to happen. Are they going to happen if Apple introduces a car in the next 5 years? I'm going to say no. No.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with that ridiculous pronunciation of no.
I mean, because we all agree, like, self-driving cars are a thing that's probably going to happen maybe when we're alive, like in our lifetimes. Like, do you think that seems reasonable?
Maybe. I wouldn't even say definitely yes. I'd say maybe.
I mean, like, it may be in limited circumstances and so on and so forth, but I, you know, the technology is good enough now where you can see this is a feasible thing that could happen. Because effectively, do we have self-flying planes? Pretty close. Like, we have planes that do a lot and, you know, can almost land themselves and almost take off themselves and almost fly from, you know, there's a person involved, so on and so forth. Self-driving cars are an easier problem because you know.
Well, self-driving cars are much more a regulatory and public perception problem than a technology problem for the most part. I think we're going to have the technology. I mean, we're not that far off today. We're going to have the technology to do them reasonably well, relatively speaking, fairly soon. Like in the grand scheme of things, fairly soon. You know, next, probably within the next decade, the technology will be pretty usable. But it might take a lot longer for not only regulation to allow them in different states and countries, but like the first time one gets in an accident and kills somebody, that's going to set them back like 10 years in regulation and how the public perceives them.
Yeah. I mean, I think they'll be pretty resilient to that because like during the time we were doing this podcast, like X number of people die in car crashes driven by people.
People aren't rational. Like people know, like, you know, it's the same thing. Like people freak out about driving to the airport or about flying and then, you know, drive to the airport and not even think about their risk of dying driving to the airport. Like people are not logical and rational with calculating risk, and something that seems totally out of their control, like a self-driving car made by the people who want you to reset your password constantly. Like a self-driving car, like that is a very scary concept to a lot of people, myself included, and I'm a technology guy. Like mm-hmm. It would be very hard. It's going to be very, very hard for people to be willing to trust self-driving cars. And the first time anything goes wrong with one, that's going to tarnish their image for years to come. Like it's going to be a tough battle.
Yeah, I mean, like, a couple of things from the chat room. One, talking about, I was saying that electric cars, you know, are self-driving cars in limited scenarios. Like, we already have that in some degrees, like, as a very limited scenario and very vague definition of cars. All those robots that drive all over factories, right? That is obviously very limited. I would imagine the first place you're actually going to see self-driving cars is probably someplace like Disneyland, like an amusement park, where it's technically not really a car. Like, it's all contained within the park, going unknown routes. Like, they basically have things like that now. You know, it's like a monorail, but without the rail, right? That type of technology is coming quickly. And Google's ones are able to do their area because they have mapped every inch of the terrain and stuff. Like, it'll just expand outward from there. And I made a comment about self-driving cars being easier than planes, mostly because, and this is contentious in the chat room, but I'm going to say mostly because if there's any kind of problem with a self-driving car, it can stop and pull over. Right. That is not an option in a plane. Like, say there's no human available to drive. The failure mode of a self-driving car involving slowly coming to a stop and pulling over, that is not available to you if the AI driving a plane loses its bearings and has no idea what the hell to do. There is no, okay, well, I'll just do nothing. And, like, you know, I'll just turn myself off and I'm sure we'll be fine. Like, that is at least a viable option in a self-driving car. Granted, cars behind you could rear-end you, so on and so forth, but you don't fall out of the sky. Whereas the AI driving a plane, if there is no human available and you are over the middle of the ocean and the AI is super confused and has no idea what to do, it does not have an option of saying, I'll just turn myself off. I'm sure we'll be fine.
That's mostly true. But, you know, there are whole plane parachutes that will, I'm serious, for like Cessnas.
They will let you drift slowly down onto the middle of the Atlantic.
Exactly.
And you'll be fine.
Wait, that works?
Yeah, I'm not kidding. This is actually on the news a few weeks ago that some like very, very small light aircraft like Cessnas or things like that, you can apparently get an entire parachute that will keep the entire plane, you know, from plummeting to the ground and rather just floating its way down to the ground, or in this hypothetical, the middle of the Atlantic, where it, at which point you drown.
And people are posting the thing of like the pilots who are, you know, that self-flying planes are causing problems with pilots because they get out of touch with the plane itself. And that's totally true. Self-driving cars will make people worse drivers for sure. And if they become super commonplace 3 generations from now, no one will know how to drive anymore, but no one will care. It'll be fine. But we'll all be dead, so you don't have to worry about it.
I don't want to give up on driving, though. I like driving.
Well, so that was my meta point here. I was going to use a reference that neither one of you are going to get, but what else is new? The whole ideas of self-driving cars and ride sharing, and you use an app and a self-driving car just shows up and you don't have to own a car. Like, we all own the cars, man, or whatever. Like, just that whole sort of utopian future of driverless cars not owned by anybody runs up against one very big problem, aptly pointed out by the seminal 90s movie that you two have never seen. And that reason is people love their cars.
I don't even know what you're referring to, but I agree with that statement, literally.
Yep.
That was a running gag in this movie. Was some, I think his idea was called Supertrain. I'm not entirely sure. It might be. You should actually watch it to find out if there's this deep broader connection. But he had an idea for like a train that's going to, this super train that's going to transport everybody. I don't remember who was super, but anyway, and he kept pitching it to people, and the people would look at it, and he had like a scale model, and saw how it would be great and reduce commute times and blah, 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 and they'd be like, yeah, it looks like a good idea, but people really love their cars, and like that would undercut him constantly. The chat room is saying it really was Supertrain. Anyway, we'll put a link in the show notes to this movie, but in the grand tradition of not telling you where sugar water comes from, we will not tell you what this movie is.
Our final sponsor this week is lynda.com, LYNDA.com. Lynda.com is an easy and affordable way to help you learn with high-quality, easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on software, web development, graphic design, and more. Go to lynda.com/ATP to see for yourself. They have fresh new courses added daily. They have courses for all experience levels, whether you're a beginner or advanced, and every lynda.com course is produced at the very highest quality. This is not like the inconsistent, often pretty bad videos that you find for free on the internet. These are real pros making real pro videos with amazing production values. The courses are broken up into bite-sized pieces. You can learn at your own pace, and you can learn from start to finish, or you can just jump in and find a quick answer or refer to something. Every video has a searchable transcript. It's actually really cool. It scrolls in the side as the video plays, so you can see what they're saying, what they just said, what they're about to say. You can jump around, and it jumps to that part in the video. Really cool stuff. They have playlists. They have LinkedIn certificates you can publish when you complete videos. You can even learn while you're on the go with lynda.com apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. And you can watch whatever you want with no pressure or commitment because you don't pay per video. You pay one low monthly price of just $25 a month, and that gives you unlimited access to all of their video tutorials. They have over 100,000 of them. And they're, of course, always adding more. $25 a month flat rate for unlimited access to their entire catalog. This is great. I love this because you can just jump in. You can, if you want, if you're just curious about something, or if you need, like, you know, you have a project that you were, that you want to do that requires you to learn some new program, like, you know, Adobe Illustrator or something like that, you can just jump right in, learn a lot about it, and do it. It's really great. They also offer a premium plan. If you're a premium member, you can download courses to your iPhone, iPad, or Android and watch them offline. And they can also you can also download sample project files if you want to. Now, lynda.com has amazing selection of courses. They have app and web development, tons of programming languages. They also have, you know, as I mentioned, productivity apps, the Adobe Creative Suite apps. They have pro apps like Logic Pro, Final Cut Pro. They even have professional skills like, you know, management training or negotiation skills, or even, as Mike Hurley told me, body language, which is pretty cool. Anyway, most of us use software for our jobs today. For any software you rely on, lynda.com can help you with the ins and outs, teach you tips and tricks, and keep you current with updates and new features as they come out. It is so useful that 30% of colleges and universities and most of the Ivy League schools offer lynda.com subscriptions to their students and faculty members. That's how good it is. That's a huge number. Anyway, lynda.com/ATP, get a 10-day free trial. You can access all their courses for free for 10 days, as much as you can watch. lynda.com/ATP. Once again, 10-day free trial. Thanks a lot to lynda.com for sponsoring our show once again.
You know, looking at this, the origins of Supertrain, the fact that it was from a movie that was about grunge people in Seattle makes me think that it is almost certainly either unconscious or conscious origin of Roderick's Supertrain thing. Because I can almost guarantee that he saw that movie and internalized it in some way. So I'd be interested to know, actually, if he was consciously referencing that Supertrain or he has never seen this movie.
Oh, you're rocking my world, man. Next year you're going to know, you're going to say BMW doesn't make most of their cars.
Yeah. They do the important part, but pushing on the logo, the little propeller logo on the front.
They make the engine.
Yeah, sort of.
What do you mean, sort of? We watch them make the engines.
Seriously.
Yeah, yeah. How many? A lot of parts go into an engine. Do they make the spark plugs? Do they make the wires? Do they make the belts? You know.
I don't know.
No, I don't know. It doesn't matter. It's a BMW
Probably
car.
Not.
Yeah. Right. It takes a village to make a car, really.
All right, so where are we in this follow-up? Because I'm lost now.
I think we're still in people's delusions of grandeur about what Apple can do. We just passed by the guy who was thinking that, like, we'll all share the cars, they'll be autonomous, and you'll just get in with your iPhone, and the car will become your car because, like, your interface will spread out all over it.
Yeah, but then you get to, like, sit on someone else's fart cushion and smell their cigarettes and their cat hair on the seat. Like, come on.
Yeah, well, it's San Francisco. Nobody smokes, right? I hope. I'm led to believe. The other one, all right, so the next fantasy scenario is, like, there's so much more to driving than just the car. You have to think about everything else, like the traffic lights, the signs, the speed limits, communication with all of those things, communication with all the other cars. Apple traffic lights, Apple stop. I'm reading from an email, people, unless you think I'm making fun of something. Apple traffic lights, Apple stop sign. Wow, the list goes on. What a money earner worldwide. Yes, if Apple could snap its fingers and have interactive electronic traffic signals, signs, and own every car on the road so they could all communicate with each other and all could communicate with the traffic signals and detect things from the signs without having to OCR the speeds off them like Marco's fancy car does, that wouldn't be an amazing utopian scenario. I think it's a little bit of a tall order to think that Apple, I mean, what's next? Why not just say that Apple should lay super cooled superconducting magnets throughout every road in the entire world, and then we could have levitating cars. Like, all of these things are technically possible.
Well, also, like, if you imagine, like, the actual reality, like, can you imagine the business of selling traffic lights and stop signs to, like, every municipality around the country? Like, that's probably a terrible, low-margin business.
It's like, wait, so hear me out, okay? Step one, replace every traffic signal and sign in the United States. Wait, now hear me out, because it's a big payoff at the end of this. All right, step two, replace every car in the United States with an Apple car that all communicate with each other. Now, once you've done that, that's the prerequisites. Now you can have a car that can talk to all the other cars, that can talk to the signals, that can make traffic flow intelligently. It's like, All right, then. Yep. Yep. Okay. I'm going to say that that is probably in line with the idea, like Marco was saying, that I think it's worse than the iPad being some amazing thing and not just being a big iPod Touch. Like all this stuff, like these are all technically possible. They're all happening slowly, like this stuff happens. Looking for Apple to be the savior to snap its fingers and make all these things that are going to eventually happen happen on a much abbreviated time scale. I can understand why people look for that, because like look what they did with the smartphone. We probably would have gotten to where the iPhone was eventually, but Apple sort of accelerated that massively by making a phone that was just leaps and bounds ahead of where everyone else was. And then everyone else said, oh, yeah, we should do that. And then it took them a couple of years and they all did. And we're all moving along with smartphones looking like iPhones now. Can Apple do that with things at the scale of traffic signals and signs? The best I think you could hope for, even if Apple was aiming for this, is to have something like this working where the rich people live in California as a proof of concept, in the same way that, Google's has its self-driving cars driving around in a limited range to show that, yes, this is something that can be done. But it's a big leap to go from getting this to work in Disneyland or where the rich people live in California, which is probably a lot like Disneyland, to this works in the entire United States, to this is the way transportation works on the entire planet. So I'm not holding my breath for any of that.
All right. Do you want to talk about China and the Apple Car? Because clearly, if you can't sell it in the United States, China's the answer.
I think the China thing, from this feedback from Rob Lewis, is all the manufacturing, and Horace went into this on iSimco as well, all the manufacturing capacity in China. If Apple was looking for someone to build their car, there's a lot of car manufacturing capability and know-how in China that is ready to be tapped. They're talking to Magna. I think Magna has locations in North America and Europe, but not in China, maybe. But as Rob points out, Apple has existing relationships with a lot of big manufacturing capacity in China, so surely some part of the Apple Car is going to be made or assembled in China, because, like, you know, that's... I don't think Apple is building a gigafactory to build its battery starting from sand in the United States. I assume they're going to contract out to somebody else to help them to make the parts for their stuff. And so, yeah, I'm sure China will be involved. Will Apple be selling their cars in China? Does China need electric minivans? Probably. They've got a booming middle class. It's a growth opportunity. There are a lot of people in China. I'm not sure if their entire strategy will hinge on China, but surely they'll be involved, as they are with everything having to do with manufacturing these days, it seems.
So is that it? Did we make it?
Then we're down to the sugar water and the iSimco link explaining auto capacity utilization. He tweeted something. It was like a graph of like who has unused capacity for automaking. And China is at 64% capacity. And everyone else is like at 70% or 80% and has a smaller overall capacity. So if you're looking for somebody who's got excess manufacturing capacity for autos, China is it.
So about that Pebble Time.
I kept reading that name in the tweets and thinking, is this like a pun or a joke, or is this the name of the product? But I guess...
Stop. Pebble Time.
Yeah, that's the name of the product. I mean, I guess it's a good name for a watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything Pebble is doing right now is smart. They are in a tough spot, and given the tough spot they're in, they seem like they're making the right moves to not die, or at least to prolong death. Right? I mean, because, like, you know, like, so they start out with the smartwatch that is basically a notifications display for mostly iPhones. You know, some Android people bought them, but I think most of the buyers probably had iPhones. You know, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that Apple was never going to give them the level of access they needed to the notification system to have any kind of, like, two-way communication or any kind of rich functionality. And so they tried having their own apps and their own SDK to custom integrate with it, but... And they still do, but I think the reality is that's really not going to go incredibly far in the Apple ecosystem, just because of the limitations imposed by iOS and the hardware. And Apple's never going to open that up.
Once Apple makes a watch, then it's time for people to go, all right, well, never mind then.
Right. And so you know, they're not stupid. They saw this, and they, I think, pretty smartly are much more embracing the Android side, and I think that's wise, you know. And I don't want to go too far into Pebble stuff, because our friends over at Connected covered it way better than we could, because they actually, at least Mike actually has used a Pebble. I don't know if the other guys have, I forget, but you know Mike has actually spent a lot of time using one, and as far as I know, none of us have, right?
I've not, no.
I've only seen one in real life, and it looked so incredibly giant and nerdy. It's like, that's even too nerdy for us. And that's really saying a lot. I mean, you know.
Don't you think that's a continuing problem with the Pebble? I know they had the Pebble Steel, which was an attempt to be fashionable that I think mostly failed because it wasn't very fashionable. It just looked like someone trying to be fashionable. And I've seen people applauding, maybe it was you, Marco, applauding the idea that the Pebble Time doesn't try to do that anymore and it just looks like...
No, I didn't say that.
A gadget. Maybe it was Gruber saying it just looks like a gadgety thing again. It's like, I don't understand. Like, it's fine to say you're not going to go like the fashion route. Like, this is not a fashion accessory. It's a gadget accessory. It's fine. Like, you're selling these in a small volume. Nerds like Android. It's like a Kickstarter type thing. Like, yeah. Does it have to be so darn ugly, though? Like, you can make something that looks like a tech nerd toy that, like, I just, all of the Pebbles, the original one, the Steel, and this new one, do not look attractive to me. And I'm not demanding fashion wise. I just want it to, like, if they just made it an unadorned box, it would look better. Because these things just look like weird thermoses with like bulges and borders and things poking out of them. Anyway, yeah, I've seen a lot of Pebbles in real life. They haven't particularly appealed to me. But, you know, the smart move that Pebble is making here is not even attempting to compete with any of the smartwatches, because our differentiator is our battery lasts for 7 days because we have an e-ink screen. Period. The end. Done. Is anyone else going to do that? I don't even know if they have any competition.
And I think it's also fairly, it's also more waterproof, right?
I'm not sure. I mean, I suppose it could be, because, like, you know, there's less stuff inside it. The screen is, you know, the CPU is super weak. Everything about it is like, we are going the opposite extreme, because Apple is not going to make a watch in their first outing with the battery last 7 days. They're going to be lucky if you can get through a day without charging the thing, right? Pebble says we can go the whole week. Why? Because we have an e-ink screen. An e-ink screen you're not going to be watching video on. What do you mean video? Forget it. We're just, you know, we're showing you information about calendars and notifications, stuff like that. That's what they're trying to do. And even that, like, you know, what was the Kickstarter? Is it like 15,000 phones or 15,000 watches or something like that? Apple sells 15,000 iPhones like every 3 minutes or whatever the hell it is. Like, it's, you know, the volumes are very small. This is a boutique thing for gadget nerds, and it has found a way.
For reference, it's already like past 50,000, it looks like. It's raised almost $10 million for whatever it's worth at the time of recording, and it's going up still.
Yeah. So how long does it take Apple to sell that many iPhones? Like, a day or two.
Sure. I mean, it's not the same game. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, they started out as a small company, started on Kickstarter, and in many ways, it looks like that's just the route they're going to continue on as long as they can. And it might be indefinitely. It might be a long time. You know, they might be around for a while. There are a lot of gadget nerds, obviously. I mean, look how quickly this thing, it reached its goal in like something like 20 minutes. And now it's way now, you know, as I said, it's raised almost $10 million right now. And there's still a month left in the campaign. So, you know, this thing obviously, like, and this is all just pre-sales. Like, once it's out, if it gets good reviews, maybe people will buy it more. I mean, once it's out, the Apple Watch will be out, and that's going to take a lot of wind out of the sails here. But still, you know, if they embrace the Android ecosystem, the Android ecosystem is freaking huge. Like, so it, and if you look at the Android Wear watches that they're competing with in that ecosystem, the Android Wear watches really have not gone very far. Everyone who has tried them so far has had pretty mixed reviews of them. None of them have really taken off. And if, you know, if they can, they're obviously not going to win on style. You know, the rest of the Android Wear watches have a better chance than this does, and that's not saying a whole lot. They're not going to win on style. But for all the other things, you know, the battery life, the possible water resistance, the durability, cost, I mean, these things are really cheap. I think they're at $200, something like that, a little under $200. Yeah, about $200. So these things are, you know, there's a big market for this if smartwatches are going to be a thing that takes off. And I think it's pretty clear that's probably going to happen. So I think they're going to do okay for quite a while. And I think it's wise for them to push further into the Android ecosystem, because iOS is just not going to go that far for them.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that, like, you know, saying, oh, this is a small market, it only applies to gadget nerds. You can't even get the gadget nerds if what you try to make is a gadget that is like the Apple Watch, but worse. Because even the gadget nerds don't want that. Like, nobody wants that, right? So that's why it's so important. It's like, well, if it's just 50,000, 100,000 people or whatever, who cares? Like, you know, these people obviously like it to be all gadgety and cool. But if you made something that had an LCD screen, needed to be charged, like, it was basically just a worse Apple Watch, nobody wants that. Not even the gadget nerds want that. Like, they'll just buy Android Wear if they want, like, an Android-powered watch. So you have to do something different than everybody else, even if you just have a small market. And so that's why they're being super smart here, because it seems like, as far as I know, no one else is even trying to make a color e-ink smartwatch. Like, are they the only one in the entire world? Like, regardless of how they're doing it with the specific technologies, 7-day battery. Nobody making an Apple or Android Wear style smartwatch would ever say 7-day battery. There's no way in hell you're getting 7-day battery from your Apple Watch. That is a big difference, and that will actually appeal to gadget nerds. Whereas if you made just a worse Android Wear watch, now you're competing with Motorola, now you're competing with Apple, now you're competing with all of them. So very smart move by that Kickstarter. And what they're essentially doing is exploring an avenue for wearables, because at this point we don't know, like, is it a deal breaker because that you have to charge your Apple Watch every day, or do people not care?
And we don't know yet. That's the real answer. They're like, we don't know.
Yeah. And Pebble has shown that, like, they, at least among gadget nerds, because I see a lot of people wearing the original Pebble.
You can't miss it.
Yeah, exactly. That was enough to get a bunch of people to wear smartwatches. I have only seen one other person wear an Android Wear smartwatch, and that person happened to be reviewing that product. So I don't know if that counts. But I see many Pebbles in my travels in nerd circles. So Pebble may be onto something. And if they are onto something, it's bad for them, because then all of the Android manufacturers, and maybe even Apple, will just make a watch like that. And eventually it's bad for them, because presumably eventually the Apple Watch will have at least a multi-day, if not 7-day, battery life, you know, 5-7 years from now. But gather ye rosebuds, Pebble. This is your time.
Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, CocoConf, Harvest, and Lynda.com, and we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLISS. So that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRACUSA, Syracuse. It's accidental.
So, Marco, for the first time in your life, you actually did some homework?
I did. It was very hard. It was a lot of work. I really struggled through to do it for the show.
I feel for you. It's a difficult task.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So after the last show, we were talking about, you know, electric cars and what Apple might do and the Tesla and everything. And we got a number of comments in the chat and a number of emails immediately afterwards saying, you should really drive an electric car to know what you're talking about. So I had to do this. I had to go and test drive a Tesla on, you know, this past Saturday, just so I could know for the show what we're talking about.
It's so kind of you to take one for the team, because God knows I would hate to have to go and drive a Tesla. God, would that suck.
I had to drive like 20 minutes to go to the place each way. It was hard. So let me preface this by saying I'm a big Phish fan. As you know from listening to our show, I like the fish. I like Phish music, not the fish that you eat or that swim in the ocean. I don't like them at all.
I can't wait to see how this connects.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Now, even though I'm a Phish fan, if you can think of what you think of when you think of Phish fans, I don't care that much about going to the live shows, even though I listen to all the live shows.
You're not a pan man.
I'm not a pan man. I don't do any drugs. And the one time I did go to a Phish show, I didn't do any drugs there either. And so...
Well, you know, not directly.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. But according to other Phish fans, to the things they like, the things they value, I'm really like a terrible Phish fan. I'm just terrible. So similarly, I'm also a fan of BMW sports cars. But among them, so I really prefer all-wheel drive. I never bring my car on a track. I don't take it anywhere and do donuts in parking lots. I always drive with traction control on, and I generally prefer luxuries like, you know, comfy seats, even though they're heavy, you know, stuff like that, like motorized sunroofs, you know, heated seats, all that stuff. It's all this heavy luxury stuff in cars. I like that. So similar to how I'm a terrible Phish fan, I'm also a terrible sports car owner, according to the priorities of most other sports car owners. So I went to this Tesla driving thing where they had like a table set up at some like health club, and you could go in, you could sign up and go in and test drive it, you know, for a certain time slot. So I went up to this thing, and I was told it would be the new P85D model, the super fast one that had that crazy reactions video that has the all-wheel drive and the super fast motor. So, and it was, although unfortunately it was white. But so going into this drive, I knew that I was about to drive this giant, heavy, but very fast all-wheel drive electric car, right? Now, I knew going in, academically, I knew it was going to be significantly faster than my car. But I also, what I expected based on how we were talking about it and what I've heard from other people and what I saw in a Tesla mall showroom like 2 years ago, I was also expecting it to have a less luxurious interior, and more importantly, to just be less sporty. Like, I knew it would be fast, but I also was not expecting it to be sporty. I expected it to be just kind of more, you know, tame handling, more cushy, and a little bit less luxurious on the inside. So the interior of the car that I saw was actually very nice. I would say it is not as nice as like a decked out high-end 5 Series, but it was a lot less far off than it used to be. It was pretty close. I immediately got in and backed up out of the parking spot. I really, really missed the heads up display and the top down parking view.
Top down parking view. Boy, we're talking about the automated cars make us bad drivers. You can't even drive without a simulated bird's eye view of his car.
No. Well, look, with the bird's eye view, I've never scraped a rim. Not once. I do a lot of parallel parking in really tight city spots. I've never scraped a rim.
I don't scrape my rims the old-fashioned way, by parking way too far away from the curb.
Well, yeah. So, anyway, yeah, because, you know, Boston's known for its, like, this wide, spacious roads, especially now with all the snow.
Yeah, our roads are really wide now. We can fit one car barely through.
If that, yeah. All right, so it doesn't have a heads-up display. It doesn't have the side camera saw for the top-down view. So that's unfortunate in a car of this class, of this price range, but oh well, move on. They do offer some of the luxuries that I come to enjoy, like a heated steering wheel. Very few cars offer heated steering wheels. Once you have a heated steering wheel, it's quite even my 3 Series had it before this, and it's so nice. It's amazing. Way better than air-conditioned seats. Those are mostly useless. Anyway, I didn't have a lot of time to play with the controls, the touchscreen thing and everything, because it was mostly just about, it was like a 15-minute drive around this course they had set up around these roads.
Now, let me interrupt real quick. Do you find that 17-inch monitor, whatever the crap it is, in the center console, does that look ridiculous to you? Because it looks freaking ridiculous to me.
It looks completely ridiculous when you look at it. In the drive, like while driving, I never had much of a reason to look at it because it sits pretty low. And this is like part of the problem is like the climate controls, which are probably the most commonly accessed things for me, are at the very bottom of that screen. And so if I wanted to adjust the climate, I didn't try doing this during the drive, so take all those with a grain of salt. If I wanted to just adjust the climate, I have to like look pretty much like almost at the floor to adjust. Like, you have to look so far off away from the road. I'm not crazy about that, and we'll see in practice. You know, maybe that'll change, or maybe I don't know about some option you can turn on. A lot of the stuff is customizable, and I spent no time playing with the controls. I was all about driving, so I can't really discuss the controls on any reasonable authority. I would say that though. The touchscreen control do look a little bit dated. Like the whole theme of the UI is very much like pre-iOS 7, pre-Metro. It's like, you know, it looks like iOS 6, basically, but, you know, less cartoony. Anyway, so get to the test drive. It's in insane mode, so I get to fully experience the speed. And so we stop. I have a clear road ahead of me. I slam on the gas, and wow.
Yeah, that good?
Wow. Like, holy handbrake. Wow. So the hard, so like, it only does that super hard acceleration. Like, if you're in the insane mode at a complete stop and you floor it, I've never felt anything like that before. There is no, the reason why it's so jarring is that there is no transition from zero. Like, you're at zero, and then all of a sudden you're just going. And once you're going, it just feels like an insanely fast car. But when you, from zero to going, it almost feels like I'm getting hit in the face. Like, it was actually unpleasant. Like, I actually didn't like it. Like, it was actually uncomfortable and unpleasant like it was like literally it feels like you're getting hit in the face. Like if I actually owned this car, I don't think I would really ever do that, because
except to scare passengers.
Yeah, except to scare passengers like once, you know, because like it really it was actually unpleasant. It's too fast. And I did it a few times. Like I did it at the beginning and the end of the test drive, just so I would, you know, have some perception of like, you know, is it just the first time that it's unpleasant? Do I get used to it? Is it less bad? Nope, it actually is unpleasant every time.
So, to put things in perspective, according to Tesla's website, the P85D does 0 to 60 in 3.2 seconds. Just as a rough equivalent, the Aerosmith Rock and Roller Coaster at Walt Disney World does 0 to 57 miles an hour in 2.8 seconds. So they're approximately equivalent. This roller coaster takes pictures of everyone on the ride every single time the ride starts, because everyone freaks out. As a matter of fact, reading from Wikipedia, the riders experience 4.5 Gs as they enter the first inversion. So, and a lot of that is, I believe, a combination of the acceleration and the turn itself. That's basically, you're driving a roller coaster.
Yeah, it's, I mean, as I said, yeah, like this, that speed going from zero to full in insane mode, I mean, it's a gimmick. You don't have any reason to actually do that in practice ever. But my God, it was so fast. And as I said, like, I mean, that was actually unpleasant. Like I actually don't have any need or want to do that.
I think the 911 Turbo does it 0-60 in 2.9 or something. So it's not even the fastest production car that you can get from 60. Like there are sub 3 supercars out there.
Yeah. But not a lot of them are these big, heavy 4-door sedans. I mean, that's the big thing. I think this is the only one.
Yeah. You don't expect it to come out of there. But what I'm saying is like that the 3 second, like being in the low to mid threes has been a thing for supercars for a long time, but it has not been a thing for a very long time for 4-door sedan looking things.
Right. I mean, my car is ridiculous and it does it in, I think, 4.2, 4.3, something like that. So like, yep. It's a pretty substantial difference. Once you're going, when you're just driving normally, it just feels like a really fast sports car. I would say it is similar but faster than the M5. You know, just it feels very similar, like on the highway, if you're passing somebody, it actually isn't that different, like going from like 60 to 80. Like it feels about the same. There actually is some responsiveness lag when you're already going fast and you want to push it to go around somebody. So it actually is very similar to a gas engine, like at highway speeds. It felt very similar to me.
Do you think that might have just been the acceleration curves on the pedal, like, you know, the, I don't forget what they call it, but like they have different curves. Like how much do you have to press the pedal to add some proportional amount of engine? And like a lot of what car makers do to make their car feel more or less sporty is to change like what happens in the first inch of travel. Is the second inch of travel add 7 times as much gas as the first inch of travel, or the reverse, you know? So I can imagine that, like, especially since because it's all electronic, where like they can decide how that curve, like they can do a software update to change it, or maybe it's the driving mode type of thing. Because it's the one thing I wouldn't expect from a Tesla is anything that is perceptible as lag having to do with the nature of the drivetrain, as opposed to just programming at a curve. Because there's no turbo spinning up, right? There's no gears being changed. It's just merely give more juice to the electric motors.
I mean, maybe I was slightly decelerating right before I did that, and the regeneration thing was kicked in. So maybe I had to like disengage the regenerative motor or the engine thing, something like that.
Oh yeah, and that's speaking of that, with the one pedal driving, how'd you like that, or were you doing that?
That actually, so the M5 has a lot of engine suction. So like compared to the M5, it just felt like it had a little bit more engine suction. Like it was. I didn't do like all one pedal driving. I was using the brakes like a normal person, but you could, you know, you could do it. I could see how you could do it. I didn't do it really to come to complete stops. I was just doing it to slow down the way I do with engine braking. So it was fine. But yeah, anyway, so like driving around, the handling, this now, John, you had mentioned that the handling feels like nothing else because it has the battery pack very low, this giant heavy weight sitting very low. So the center of gravity is very low and it handles very like it the car stays very flat. Is that a fair assessment of what you said?
Yeah. And it doesn't feel, the suspension doesn't feel overly stiff, because normally if a car is flat, that's like, you know, because they have very stiff suspension. And then when you go over bumps, you feel like you're being jostled.
Right. Going through the turns, I would say that it actually didn't feel noticeably different than my car, because like, good sports cars have always tried to achieve that. Like, they always try to have, like, very little body roll, and they'll play tricks with bars or like, the suspension, you know, like, they'll play tricks to make it better and you know, to just minimize body roll and keep the car flat during cornering. So, like, it felt great, but, like, it didn't feel dramatically better in cornering than a good sports car would.
Did you go over potholes, though? Because that, like, I think that's where you notice, because, like, I've driven your car for short distances, and driving your car over the totally destroyed roads of Massachusetts, I could feel that this, that whatever mode you had it in, that this car has sports car suspension, because, like, going over those potholes felt way rougher than it does in my Accord with its smushy, like, everyman suspension, right? Whereas in the Tesla, on the same crappy Massachusetts roads, it felt flat like your car in turns, but then you'd go over potholes, and it would also suck them up a little bit better. So I feel like the spring rates are softer on the Tesla because they can afford to be, because the center of gravity is so low and it's just less jostling. But it may be a close thing, but you know, having been a passenger in the Tesla and having driven your car, I think the Tesla wins on comfort over terrible roads, and I would assume yours wins in handling, but I haven't driven either one of them to, you know, to say what the handling is like at the extremes.
Well, okay, so the Tesla does have electric power steering. Now, I said in a couple shows ago how I've never heard anybody say that electric power steering was even as good as hydraulic steering. Like, everyone's always like, well, it's getting better, but, you know, no one ever says it's as good. So this has electric power steering. I would say it's as good.
Really?
I wouldn't say it's better, but I would say it's as good as the steering in my car. Now, again, this was only a 15-minute test drive. And so maybe if I own one of these things and drove it all the time, maybe I would have a different opinion of it. But in that test drive, I had a lot of nice turns at low and high speeds, and I did not notice the steering. Like, I asked halfway through, I'm like, oh, is this electric power steering? I realized, oh, this is probably electric, and I asked, and the guy said yes, and I was very impressed, because it felt like a good sports car steering system. And the suspension, as you said, you know, I would say the suspension felt like it was very advanced, because I was able to have a lot of fun with the steering and everything and the suspension and the speed, and it never felt either too marshmallowy like a Lexus or too uncomfortably firm like the 1M was. Like, it just felt good, but you still felt the road. You still felt what was going on. And so I have nothing bad to say about the steering or the suspension. Now, the grip. This is an all-wheel drive car. As I said earlier, I'm a fan of all-wheel drive. This car has, in my 15 minutes of test drive, in 20-degree weather on snow tires, this car has the most advanced all-wheel drive system I've ever felt. By far and away, the best all-wheel drive I've ever felt.
As measured by?
By my previous xDrive 3 series and a couple of Lexuses I've driven for parents and stuff. And I think that's all. I don't think I've ever driven a Subaru to its extreme.
The secret is they have a whole separate engine for the other set of wheels.
The all-wheel drive system in this thing was shockingly good. I have, like, it was insane. And the traction control system, now, again, this was cold weather, so the tires were a little bit hard. Cold weather. There was, because it's New York and then it's the winter, there was a bunch of gravel all over a lot of the roads. And I would do things like, you know, turning left at an intersection. So like making a 90 degree turn from a stop, just like really irresponsibly quickly, like just seeing if I could trying to lose grip. And I was able to lose grip occasionally. But what's interesting about it is not only is it very hard to lose grip, but when it does, it's not like the gas systems where they just cut the engine power for a few seconds. Which really kind of ruins the fun and makes people want to turn off these systems.
Or they use the brakes to brake individual wheels.
If it was doing that, I don't know if it was. If it was doing that, I couldn't tell. It just felt like it was the best feeling system I've ever felt. I mean, it was the best all-wheel drive system ever. I cannot say enough good things about that all-wheel drive system. And I don't know how it does in the snow. I didn't try it in the snow. I didn't have the chance. I've heard it's very good, but I don't know. But just trying to drive it in a fun, slightly irresponsible, spirited way, it was amazing. It didn't feel like a nanny. It felt like it was helping me do what I told the car to do. When you go when you're doing that insane mode acceleration from zero to a million, and it hits you in the face with how fast it is, At no point in that did I ever feel like it was unsafe or about to lose control and go off the road. I have to imagine that a big part of that is this auto drive system. When you go from zero to going so quickly, you think, like, how can the tires even do this? Like, it feels like it should be beyond the limits of the tires, of the grip they can offer, but it still does it. So, traction control system, auto drive system, incredible. I would intentionally, like, take a quick turn around, like a little bend, and, like, intentionally put one of the rear wheels on gravel so that when I floored it, it should lose grip. And it did, but it would regain it so quickly. And you never felt like you were in any real danger of, like, going off the road or even slightly losing control. I mean, it was incredible. Overall, driving this car, I would say it is an amazing sports car. Like, I knew it would be fast. I did not know it would be this sporty and this fun. It was just an incredibly fun, sporty, fast, exhilarating drive. I cannot say enough good things about how amazing this car felt to drive.
It's like the Apple of cars, really.
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
Anyway, I do have some concerns. You know, if I were to own one of these things, I of course, do have range anxiety. You know, it goes like 260 miles in ideal circumstances. They have a calculator on their site, and it's like, okay, well, if you set the air conditioning to this and you actually drive this fast on the highway, you know, how much range can you actually expect? And mine was more like 200 miles, because it's like, all right, well, what if it's 100 degrees, I have the air conditioning on, and I'm driving 85? You know, so then it's down to like 200. So it's not a deal killer, but it's a big issue. I'm not sure I would want this to be our only car in our family. You know, I know people who do that, but I'm not sure I could do that. The bigger issue with this, and this ties back into what Apple might possibly do in this, because I think the answer is Apple would do something pretty similar to what Tesla's doing, because there's not much else. Because the problem is, a bigger issue, I think, is charging speed. And the reason why is because electric cars, beyond like, you know, the battery tech, in order just to move a car like this far, they just need a ton of power. Like, by household electric power standards, they just need a ridiculous amount of power. The limitation is not how quickly the batteries can accept a charge necessarily. It's much more limited by how much charge your household wiring is able to give it with the kind of outlet you have installed. Like, that's the big limitation with these cars. And, you know, and they have special high power chargers you can install, but biggest thing, like, for me, like, my concern with a road trip would be, you know, problem one would be range, but then the problem two is, like, where do you plug in when you get there? To give you some point of reference, I did a little bit of research here. So the common North American, you know, 120 volt outlet charges, if you plug into that with a Model S, you gain 3 miles of range per hour. Three.
That's not very good.
It takes about 4 days to charge your car all the way. So suppose you drive your car to somewhere where the only place you can plug in is like through some long extension cord into somebody's house or some hotel. Like, you can plug into a regular outlet. Okay. Then you have to stay there for 4 days to fully charge. So, you know, that's probably not a great option for people, right? Now, what you're supposed to do if you have one of these in your house is you're supposed to get a dryer outlet installed, a 200 volt 40 amp outlet installed, which is common for dryers these days. Into a dryer outlet, you can charge the car up fully in 9 hours, which is great. So that's fine. But, like, you know, I drive frequently to places like upstate to in-laws' house or my mom's house. I visited you guys at your houses before. How likely is it that you're going to drive somewhere and you're going to be able to plug into somebody's extra dryer outlet and have that be within like 30 feet of your where your car is parked?
Did you look for supercharger stations along your normal routes?
That's what I was going to say, because there's one very close to our house, like 10, 15 minutes away. Now, to be fair, that doesn't necessarily mean you would want to ditch your Tesla 20 minutes away from the house.
Oh, just leave it there?
Well, the superchargers charge it in less than an hour, though, right?
Yeah, they give you, I believe it's an 80% charge in about 40 minutes. So it's not a full charge, but, you know, it's enough and something like 40 minutes. Now, so I asked a couple Tesla owners, and I did some reading of, you know, what do Tesla owners do? You know, how do you take road trips? Because chances are you're not going to want to, like, arrive at someone's house nearly empty and then just, you know, not have anywhere to plug in. That's not great. And you're also probably not going to want to be bugging your hotel or your friend's house or your parents to be like, hey, can I run this giant extension cord to your dryer outlets? Like, if they even have one. I mean, how many people do you know who have a spare dryer outlet, period? You know, let alone one that you can use that is in range of your car, like physical range. So that's not a great solution. That's not a great position to be in. And I've heard from a number of people, thank you for all those people who have responded to me, heard from a number of people who have told me about various, like, there are apps and maps, and like there's, I think, called PlugShare, if I remember correctly. There's like a site where like people can volunteer their houses to other EV owners. Like, you can use my charging point at my house when if you're passing through. Like, that's all cool and everything, but like that's I really prefer to be independent and to not need to rely on, like, you know, going around some weird neighborhood at night, like trying to figure out, like, hey, where's the nearest charge point? Can I charge up here? Like, trying to like bum something off somebody. That's not my style. I really would feel very uncomfortable doing that. So you can do it, but it's not easy, and it's not convenient, and it's not great. And from what I gather, what most people do is you basically supercharge right before you get somewhere. And then when you leave, like on your way out, you supercharge as you leave. And that way you have like enough charge to do some local driving while you're there. And then, you know, on the highway, you're fine. But you know, every time you stop at a supercharger, that adds like an hour to your trip. You know, like you got to get there, stop, plug in. Hopefully there's nobody already taking up all the spots. That's a big problem if there is, because that adds another 40 minutes to your trip. You wait for them to come back. Hopefully you plug in, you get 40 minutes of charge there. You know, you go in, have some lunch or whatever. But that's a big delay for a road trip, especially if the trip's only like, this is only every 250 miles or so. So like, it's only like every 3 or 4 hours you got to stop for an hour. Like, that kind of sucks.
Now, did they ever actually start doing the 5 minute complete battery swap? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, they talked about that. I don't know if that's actually deployed anywhere. I'm not sure that I would do it necessarily, but it's an interesting idea, because, you know, again, like, the problem here is just the speed at which you can deliver this much power into such a tremendous battery pack. I mean, that's going to be hard to solve. And this is like Apple, if Apple does a pure electric vehicle, you could do a fuel cell. You know, fuel cells are options. I know Toyota announced, I think today, that they're doing a fuel cell vehicle. So that's interesting. But then you need hydrogen everywhere. And that's has its own set of challenges and issues. Anyway, so this is a problem. You know, it's not a deal killer for a lot of people, but it is certainly a major inconvenience. You know, the fact that you can't just fill up anywhere, and that filling up takes so long. That is really a problem. And again, not a deal killer for a lot of people, but a significant problem and a significant barrier to adoption. Anyway, so I have some reservations about whether I should own one of these things. The practical side of it, that would concern me.
But you don't have any reservations about whether your wife should own one of these.
Well, she likes her car a lot. If we bought one of these, it would have to be my car.
Did you look at the luggage space and like the general, you know, 3GT-ishness? Like, I feel like the space in this car, maybe not as cavernous as her current car, but like, it's in the ballpark, right?
I think it might have more total space, even though the 3GT has a pretty nice wide opening to the back, but the Tesla might have more overall space. Anyway, I would say it was the driving experience of this overall was the best driving car I've ever driven, period.
Better than yours?
Yeah.
Wow.
I really would like to have more time driving one of these things, even though I have reservations about in practice. So anyway, after the test drive, I went back to my car to drive it home for 20 minutes. Going from the P85D to an M5, it made the M5 feel like two words that nobody has ever used to describe an M5. Slow and light.
Those are two words that no one has ever used to describe an M5. You're absolutely right.
I would add a third one, noisy, but that's just the radio anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Now, yeah, so going back to the M5, I immediately missed the all-wheel drive. Immediately, because, you know, it was a cold day on the hard tires, even though both cars had winter tires on them, but I immediately missed the all-wheel drive. Going back to shifting gears. Now, I have discussed many times, and Casey, you too, you know, I love manually shifting my gears. I do it with a DCT now, I did it with a stick in the past. And I do this because I don't like the way automatics feel and behave, and they make the decisions for you. I want maximum responsiveness for what I intend to do with the car, and I can only really get that by shifting gears. I don't shift gears manually because I like the actual work of managing what gear the car is in and how it matches up with the engine, you know, power and everything. Like, the actual work of shifting the gears, I don't care that much about, which is why I had no qualms going to the DCT from the manual and why I don't regret that move at all. I want the car to behave the way I want and to have the power available the way I want. Not necessarily do I need to be shifting gears constantly. Having no gears at all and having infinite power available at any speed with very little lag, I can honestly say, after 15 minutes of driving it at least, that's just better. Like, it's simply better. Like, I thought it would be less fun or less like a driving experience, but it wasn't. It just felt better. And, you know, it really, overall, it really felt like, when I went back to my car, it immediately felt like the clunky, bad hack that gas cars really are. Like gas cars are such terrible hacks. Piles and piles of terrible hacks on top of terrible hacks. And you know, John, as you said last week, like, the Tesla has so many fewer parts. It's such a simpler mechanical thing. You feel that. Like, you can really tell that this, you know, this all-electric drivetrain, it is something else. It is really something else. And unfortunately, this something else, I think, has ruined me forever. Like, just having driven it once, like, now I'm ruined. Now every gas car seems like an old, clunky hack.
Did you look in the frunk?
I did. Yeah.
And the back? That's what I say, like, where's the car? You open up all the doors and you open up all the things, you're like, this is like a magic trick.
I know. Well, and like, they have, like, in my mall showroom, which I went to the mall a few days ago for something else, so I stopped at the showroom to look at their paint and stuff. They have like a disassembled one where it's only the drivetrain.
Yep.
So, and they have these, I'm sure, in most of their showrooms. It's just like this giant silver rectangle of batteries with wheels on the corners, and that's about it. Like, there's not much more to it.
And it has, but it has the motors though, right?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
And so, like, then it's like, you think, oh, okay, well, this is just the chassis, and then you'll have to add, like, the engine. And it's like, no, that's, you could drive that thing if you put a steering wheel on it, right?
Yeah.
It's the car, it's the wheels, it's the suspension, it's the battery, and it's the power sources for all of the wheels.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it really, I would say don't drive one of these. Because it will ruin you. Like, I mean, it is, you know, my lease is coming up in a year. And an all-wheel drive M5 is probably going to come out in about 3 more years. But I think by the time an all-wheel drive M5 comes out, I will probably already be driving one of these. And I won't want to go back to a gas car. Like, no matter how good of a gas car it is, once you've driven one of these things, it is shockingly different and shockingly good. Like, again, I thought there was going to be major trade-offs in fun and sportiness and handling, and there just weren't at all. Like, it was just better. It was so much better and so much simpler and so much, it's almost more pure, you know, from a purist perspective. Like, it's more pure because there's like less stuff like managing all these different like hacks and levels of power delivery. It's just, you just push the pedal to go and you can do whatever you want with the steering, and it's just amazing. And so I think, you know, if I can make an analogy to conclude this whole long rant that's now been almost a half hour long, electric cars are a lot like SSDs and the transition to SSDs, where, you know, as soon as you use an SSD for the first time, it ruins you. You know, like, as soon as you see an SSD, you're like, oh man, I can never go back to it. And as soon as you have used one, any spinning disk that you use after that, it's just like, oh, this is horrible. It's so slow. It's such a hack. You know, it's terrible. So once you've driven an electric car, it's very similar. It's like, you just, it ruins everything else for you. But like the SSD transition, it also comes with significant cost and significant limitations up front. And maybe eventually, down like years down the road, maybe we'll be past that, but it's going to be slower than the SSD transition was. And so pure electric cars are incredible in a lot of ways. Inconvenient and limited and expensive in other ways, but they're just so much better at the core driving experience in so many ways that I think a lot of people are going to be willing to accept those costs and those limitations, just like SSDs. And I think it's very, very likely that I will get one of these when my lease is up.
Yeah, I said last week, referencing Tesla, I said that they were the first company that actually made a good electric car. Not like good for an electric car, but a good car that happens to also be electric. And it sounds like you agree.
Totally. I mean, completely, totally agree. I've already looked at, I've like priced it out with the options I want, and it is actually more expensive. But I'd like to, if I can find a dealer that has one, I'd like to test drive the non-P version, just the 85D. So it's still the all-wheel drive, but it's less power, because I don't intend to do the insane amount of acceleration from a stop, like, ever, because I actually didn't like it, as I said, like, it was unpleasant. So I'm curious, like, the non-P one, it still has all-wheel drive and everything, that is, like, $20,000 less and a good few hundred dollars a month less on the lease. So I'm going to look at that and see if I can drive one of those and see if I care about the difference. But I'm pretty sure I'm going to be getting one of these things. And Casey, never drive one, because this will ruin you too. Like, this is how the manual transmission is going to die. We all thought that it was going to die because everyone would move to automatics. In reality, the manual is going to be killed by the lack of a need for a transmission.
Yeah, you're right. It's wild to me that you liked it that much. The fact that you liked it, not really surprising at all. The fact that you liked it this much, I do find surprising, especially because, you know, I feel like BMW and Apple, and I know you guys think I'm crazy for comparing them and saying they're similar, but I really do feel like they are in a lot of ways. And Apple, in a lot of ways, tries to get you invested in the experience of owning an Apple product with the retail stores. And I'm trying to think of other examples, but I can't. But just the whole experience of owning an Apple product. Similarly, BMW, maybe they don't actively try to get you in a similar position. But, you know, when you and I and Underscore went to the performance driving school, that was certainly an actual event that we learned things. But you could also say it was a two-day BMW sales pitch that we paid for the privilege of going to see. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like you and I have bought into the whole BMW air quotes culture. And plus, we both drive like jerks, so that helps too.
A little bit, but yeah. Anyway,
but the point is, you know, I feel like you and I are slash were all in on Apple, all in on the BMW like experience. And for you to just violently say, oh my goodness, this is definitely like your head is swiveled around entirely. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing at all. In fact, that's probably a good thing, because I think this is the future. But I'm surprised how enthusiastic you are over this experience after having spent so much time going to Munich, going to the performance driving school, owning three different BMWs in the last 10 years, whatever it's been. You know, I'm surprised that you are this into it this quickly.
Well, this is true disruption. True disruption is something that makes everything else seem totally irrelevant and useless and old. Like, that's how good this was. It was incredible. And as I said, just, you know, the handling, the speed, and the all-wheel drive system were just incredible. This is going to be ridiculously successful, I think, you know, among anyone who can afford it, which is admittedly a very small group, but it's going to be really good. You know, I think what you just said, though, about, you know, buying in and being, you know, maybe a fanboy, you know, maybe that's the right word, just like, you know, like buying in a lot to one company's, you know, culture or products or identity. This is one of the reasons why, you know, right now I'm a huge fan of coffee and Apple stuff and BMWs, but there's a reason why, like, my Twitter username doesn't include, it's not like Coffee Marco or, you know, Apple Fan Marco. Like, that's, I never try to tie my identity to something that it could so easily change over time, you know? And I think it's important for everybody to consider this, like, you know, with your own identities and with, you know, the teams you think you're on, what you think makes you, you know, and if you consists of a set of like brand names and foods you like, you know, that don't tie too firmly to that, because that stuff can change. You know, what if tomorrow I develop a digestive problem and I can't drink coffee anymore? Like, I don't want to have coffee have been this giant part of my identity that all of a sudden I feel like I'm losing part of my identity, you know? Like, if BMW starts making cars I don't like, I have no problem buying something for somebody else. If Apple starts making computers I don't like, I have no problem buying computers from somebody else. I hope that doesn't happen with Apple, because the somebody else's out there are not that good. But, you know, like, if that happens, like, I'm fine changing those things. It is very important that I never, that I never lock my identity to some external like affiliation to a brand or a thing that I can't easily get away from. Like that's unwise, and that it makes people make bad decisions and have stupid conversations and leave stupid comments in people's comment forms. So yeah, I mean, look, I like right now I have a BMW because I think it was the best car in the world that I could get at the time that I got it, and I worked hard enough to get it, and I was really happy about that, and I still am very happy with it. But now I've found something that is substantially better in a few key ways that matter a lot to me. And again, in some key ways, it's substantially worse. You know, my car can go 300, 400 miles easy on the highway, and then I can stop and I can fill up in 10 minutes anywhere and go. And you can't do that with a Tesla. And that's not going to be the kind of thing that all of a sudden comes next year. Like, that's going to be a long-term thing that you might never be able to do. Like, it's not even guaranteed. Like, oh, eventually they'll charge in 10 minutes, it'll be fine. Like, that might never happen. Certainly within the lifetime of the car that you buy today, that you own, within the lifetime of anything we buy today, that almost certainly won't happen. But you need to be open to the possibility of something better might come along, right? And I think in this case, something did.
If there are any wealthy benefactors listening to this show, please keep in mind that I still want the mid-engine V8 Ferrari, whatever the current one is. So that's 488, you know, and just keep up with the model. So just that has not changed.
Wow. Now, Marco, I think just to close this post show, just let this show you that every great once in a while, doing your homework is actually worth it.
Yeah, probably not. That was really long. I'm sorry. That was incredibly long.
Talking about brand affiliation and everything. Everything you said is true. But in your case specifically, I think that what it highlights is that the aspect of your personality and your dealings with sort of products and brands that wins out over brand allegiance is your desire for new shiny things. And so that is the primary motivator of your actions, and that, oh, this is better. Oh, is there something better? Oh, that's better. Oh, that's better. And that sort of nature of like, which doesn't manifest itself in your programming language things, but totally manifests itself
in, not at all.
in your choice of foods, cleaning foods. Materials, like things that you buy, you know what I mean? Like the cars that you drive, the computers that you use. Oh, I got to get a new Mac Pro. Oh, now the new iMac is shinier. Like, just, you are always looking for a product that's better than the product you have. Testing a million light bulbs. Is there a better light bulb than these 8 light bulbs I have already tried? Is it better in some subtle way? I need to find the best light bulb.
It's been a while with light. I got to look at light bulbs again. It's been a while.
You don't have any brand allegiance to light bulbs. You're just like, I just want the best light bulb. And if there's a better light bulb out there and I don't have it, I'm just replacing every light bulb in this damn house. Like, I got an M5. Now it's crap. I need an electric car.
No, it's not crap, but it's just like, I found something that's just way better.
I know, but like, it was saying, but that your personal drive to find the best one of whatever for the things that you are into is overriding. But because I think you do have some allegiance to, like, you know, you really like BMWs, you like what they do, you bought multiple BMWs or whatever, but that's only until you find something that's better than them. Like, it doesn't, that overrides the loyalty, because you did have loyalty to BMW for the, you know, the Tesla has existed. And if you had test driven the non-insane mode, non-like high-powered one of these years ago, you might have had the same reaction. Maybe without the part where you felt like you were being punched in the face, but you might have had the same reaction. What was keeping you from doing that?
Well, but it only had all-wheel drive like 2 months ago, and the high-powered motor and everything.
Yeah, I guess so too. But again, you'd have to drive the two-wheel drive one, see if it's right. You already have a two-wheel drive car now. You bought a two-wheel drive M5, so there is a little bit of like the whole brand loyalty, and, you know, and the fact that you don't want to keep looking for a new thing. Like, once you find the thing you have, you want to enjoy it for some period of time before you revisit. But I would say that is the dominant part of your personality, overriding all the other parts.
This is why I lease cars. And also because I stress out too much when I don't. Because I, oh God, oh, I hate, whenever I had a car that I owned, I was such an incredible ball of nerves and just total wreck about it. Like, any little scratch, oh my God, I'm going to look at this for 10 years. Like,
Even when you own crappy cars?
Yeah. Yeah. Because then when I owned the crappy cars, it was less about, this is going to destroy value and make me lose a lot of money, and more about, I'm going to look at the stretch of the next 10 years.
Yeah, no, I'm resigned to that. I have crappy cars, and like, I tried to keep my new car nice for a long time, but it's impossible. Like, for this winter, like, I can't imagine what my car is going to look like when I finally clean it off in the spring and see what the hell is underneath all the road salt and grime and disgustingness. But yeah,
I can tell you, it's going to look like a very average, completely forgettable car.
We already established it is not average.
It is so average.
It's more of the average from a decade ago. But anyway, I keep my cars until they die or until their resale value is almost zero. Like, you know, oh, we better sell this because if I don't sell it soon, I'm going to have to give it away and that may be difficult. Like, that's how long I keep my cars, right? So I'm not a car leaser. My Ferrari, though, I would drive very little, just so you know, and I would try to maintain its value. So don't feel like you're giving me a Ferrari.
Okay, now somebody will buy you
wealthy
one.
Wealthy benefactor who's listening, I will take good care of it.
And you won't park it under the acorn tree, right?
No, never. I will buy a different house for it to live at.
So this is why you buy used cars, is because by the time it arrives in your garage, it's already been nicked or dinged in some way, shape, or form. And so it's all, the bet's already off at that point. You could just have to embrace it. I don't think you can do the 85D. I think you'd have to do the P85D because the performance difference is substantial.
It's a large difference. Yeah. If it was like in the 4 second range versus 3.2, I'd do it.
Oh, that would be plenty.
But yeah, it's a pretty substantial difference. Yeah, I think you're right, unfortunately.
I mean, you don't have to turn on insane mode. You'll
try it because it may be what you like is the fact that there's no pauses or noise or like just the sort of the whoosh, you know, the electric. So try the slower, quote unquote, slower one and see. Because again, like, is the slower one all that much slower from 50 to 80? Maybe not that much that you would notice.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a little concerned because the Super P one, it mentions a different suspension in its description. And what I liked so much about it was the suspension and the all-wheel drive system. So I suspect I'm just going to have to go with the big one.
Well, just, you know, test them all.
I'm such an asshole.
Well, you know, you overcame that part, that part of you that was embarrassed to buy, like, the ridiculous car. You overcame that for the M5, so I feel like you've crossed that hurdle. Now you will be easier to pull the trigger on. Just give me whatever the most expensive Tesla you have is. I want that one.
Well, and this is actually, like, driving around my neighborhood, like, I do feel a little self-conscious because my car is very loud. Because the M5, like the M cars are all, they're extra loud.
Yeah, you won't have that problem anymore.
I know. And yeah, exactly. Like, and my neighbors have even made comments like, oh, we can hear you coming up the block. Like,
well, that might also have to do with you not shifting before 5,000 RPM.
Why would I?
Just saying.